Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 88-1650, Francine Taflin versus Jeffrey A. Levitt. We'll wait just a moment, Mr. Goldberger. Very well, Mr. Goldberger, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue presented in this case is whether the private civil treble damage remedy provided by Congress in the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, known as RICO, and codified at 18 U.S.C. Section 1964C, is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. We contend that Section 1964C is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. This Court, in the Gulf Offshore case, set forth the test to be applied in determining whether any given congressional enactment is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. Analysis must always begin with the presumption that jurisdiction is concurrent. Congress, however, does have the power to confer exclusive jurisdiction on the federal courts, and with respect to each congressional enactment, the question is whether Congress intended to exercise that power. This Court in Gulf Offshore set forth three methods by which the congressional intent to confer exclusive jurisdiction could be discerned. First, that congressional intent could be discerned by an explicit statutory directive that jurisdiction be exclusive. Second, the congressional intent to confer exclusive jurisdiction could be discerned by an unmistakable implication from legislative history. And third, the congressional intent to confer exclusive jurisdiction could be discerned by an incompatibility between federal interests and the exercise of state court jurisdiction.
Mr. Goldberger, do you think there's any difference between the standards laid down in Gulf Offshore and the traditional standards of the Claflin case?
Your Honor, I do not think so. There was, in Claflin, a holding that exclusive jurisdiction could be determined either explicitly or implicitly, and also a reference to incompatibility in Claflin. And I think Gulf Offshore and Claflin, therefore, are entirely compatible. With respect to Section 1964C, there is no explicit statutory directive that jurisdiction be exclusive. There is, however, an unmistakable implication that arises from the legislative history of Section 1964C, as well as exclusive jurisdiction can also be seen because of an incompatibility between the exercise.
Where do you find in the legislative history that Congress even considered the question?
Your Honor, there is no explicit legislative discussion of the question of exclusive jurisdiction. There is, however, a clear reliance on Section 4 of the Clayton Act in drafting Section 1964C of RICO.
Yeah, but that falls far short of any kind of indication by Congress that they didn't expect the normal presumption of concurrent jurisdiction to apply.
Your
it
Honor,
looks to me like you're just left with your argument on incompatibility, and I'm not sure it is.
Your Honor, I think under this Court's decisions in the Cannon case and Lorillard versus Pons, that when Congress bases one statute on another statute, it is presumed to know of this Court's interpretations of the first statute. And absent any change in the applicable language, to incorporate that language, to incorporate those precedents.
Well, it isn't all that clear that this court was on the right track under the Clayton Act. Why would we want to extend it to a new statute?
I think, Your Honor, whether this court was on the right track with respect to Clayton may be, in some sense, beside the point, because it is what Congress knew this court had done when it enacted Section 1964C. That is, Congress was aware of the court's decisions in Freeman versus B Machine Company and in General Investment that jurisdiction was exclusive. Thereby, when it enacted Section 1964C, it was presumably adopting those decisions as well, for it made no change in the statutory language between the Clayton Act and Section 1964C. Moreover, this court has previously recognized these two similarities between Section 1964C and Section 4 in interpreting Section 1964C. Thus, in the Sedema decision, this court was confronted with the question of whether there was a requirement that there be a prior predicate act conviction before a successful 1964C action could be brought. In part, relying on the history of the Clayton Act and this court's interpretations of the Clayton Act, the court concluded that it was such a predicate act conviction was unnecessary. The court made similar references to Section 4 of the Clayton Act and Section 1964C in trying to adopt the proper statute of limitations in the Mally Duff decision, and also in deciding whether RICO claims were arbitrable. This court also made reference to Section 4 of the Clayton Act and noted the similarity and purpose and structure between Section 4 of the Clayton Act and Section 1964C. Company and General Investment are the two cases that
Freeman versus B decided that?
Your Honor, in I believe it's footnote 4, but I'm not sure.
Don't please go on with your argument.
6, Your Honor. I'm sorry. It's note 6. Taken together, the congressional reliance on Section 4 of the Clayton Act, the modeling of Section 1964C on that section, this Court's interpretation of Section 4 as providing exclusive jurisdiction, and create the unmistakable implication that Congress intended jurisdiction under Section 1964C to be exclusive. This conclusion is buttressed by the incompatibility which arises if state courts exercise jurisdiction because of their interpretation of federal criminal offenses which Congress has provided shall only be in the hands of federal courts under Section 3231, and because of the procedural devices provided by Congress, and in addition, because of the very broad nature of RICO itself. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well, Mr. Goldberger. Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. It is striking in listening to petitioners' argument that they drop from this Court's unmistakable implication test, the word unmistakable, and that they drop from this Court's clear and disabling incompatibility test, the words clear and disabling. The governing rule here is both clear and well established. The state courts have an inherent right to adjudicate all claims that their constitutions and their state legislatures empower them to hear. It matters not whether those claims arise under state law, or under federal law, or under the laws of India or France, or any other foreign sovereign for that matter. The state courts can be stripped of their inherent power to adjudicate federal claims only in two limited circumstances, where Congress has clearly indicated its intent to do so, either by explicit statutory language or an unmistakable indication in its legislative deliberations, or where the very exercise of state adjudicatory power would be fundamentally incompatible with and inimical to Congress's purposes in enacting the particular statute or with the federal government status as a superior sovereign. This rule is deeply rooted in our federal system. For the first 100 years of our republic, the federal courts had no general federal question jurisdiction. The state courts alone had jurisdiction over most federal claims. This allocation of judicial authority reflected the conviction of the Constitution's framers and of the first Congress that the state courts were both competent and appropriate arbiters of federal claims.
Decision to say that Clayton Act jurisdiction was exclusively in federal courts meets that test?
Your Honor, I think that there are distinctions that the Court may well have relied on in determining that there was exclusive jurisdiction over the Clayton Act. First and foremost, quite in contrast to RICO, there is an indication in the legislative history that Congress thought about the issue and at least some indication that it was Congress's intent to delegate exclusively to the federal courts the responsibility for interpreting the antitrust laws. Secondly, I think the Court's decision in the Clayton Act cases is probably best explained by the remarkably open-ended texture of the Clayton Acts and the antitrust laws and the historical context in which that issue came before the Court. After all, that open texture of a law for the first time criminalizing legitimate business conduct called out to the courts to really develop a federal common law regulating business conduct that the Court may well have recognized to have a pervasive effect on interstate commerce. So I think both because of the legislative history and because of the historical context of the Clayton Acts, I think that the Court may have approached it differently than we're dealing here with today under RICO.
But, of course, the Court really didn't say anything in the B case. It just has one sentence and a footnote.
That's true, Your Honor. And in addition, the general investment case certainly doesn't go into the analysis that this Court has prescribed in Claflin and has consistently followed to this date. The rule of inherent state court jurisdiction over federal claims remained undisturbed when in 1875 Congress, for the first time, gave the federal courts general federal question jurisdiction. The rule remains undiminished today. It is particularly appropriate, we submit, to apply this historic rule of concurrent jurisdiction to RICO. Civil claims under RICO implicate no overriding issues of federal policy. Thus, we have here no specialized administrative tribunal created to interpret or enforce RICO. The vast majority of RICO cases involve claims of garden variety fraud, the type of claim with which the state courts are intimately familiar. In addition, state law violations as well as federal law violations comprise RICO's predicate acts. Moreover, the states plainly share the federal government's interest in eradicating organized crime and in compensating its victims. More than half the states have enacted their own versions of Little RICO, modeled after the federal act. And it's particularly noteworthy in this regard that each of the state high courts that has considered the issue has ruled that its courts are competent and appropriate tribunals to adjudicate federal RICO claims. Finally, and most significantly, RICO's remedial purposes will be promoted by giving victims of organized crime a choice of forums in which to assert their claims for damages. It's been conceded that RICO's legislative history is mute as to whether Congress gave thought to the issue of exclusive versus concurrent jurisdiction. Every court that has examined the Act's legislative history has come to this conclusion. As Justice O'Connor recognized, it's abundantly clear that Congress never even considered the issue. This is not surprising. This Court recognized in the Shearson American Express versus McMahon case, the addition of RICO's civil damages remedy was an 11th-hour amendment to that legislation and received only brief discussion. The only fragment of legislative history that the proponents of exclusive jurisdiction seize on is that Congress borrowed the treble damage remedy that had been used successfully in the Clayton's Act and put that remedy into the text of RICO. Whereas here it is clear that Congress never even considered the issue of whether to divest the state courts of their inherent jurisdiction, such modeling, we submit, cannot meet this Court's unmistakable implication test. Moreover, in the case of RICO, this modeling is a particularly weak analogy because, as this Court has recognized, the legislative history of RICO shows that Congress did not intend, by adopting the treble damage remedy, to bring with it all of the baggage that had been developed with the antitrust laws over the years. And particularly, there's legislative history indicating that Congress did not want to incorporate the many obstacles to enforcement of the antitrust private damage remedy that had been developed. This Court has never found an implication in legislative history sufficient to rebut the strong presumption of concurrent jurisdiction. The rigor with which this Court has applied its unmistakable implication test is demonstrated, we believe, by both Gulf Offshore and the Court's Section 1983 decisions. The legislative history of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, which the Court considered in Gulf Offshore, contained a clear statement of concern by the opponents of that bill that the law would have the effect of providing exclusive federal jurisdiction over claims under that act. The Court dismissed that evidence of legislative intent as insufficient to constitute an unmistakable implication of an intent to strip the state courts of their jurisdiction. Even more instructive is the Court's determination that Section 1983 claims are subject to concurrent jurisdiction. The legislative history of Section 1983 makes unmistakably clear that Congress's predominant concern was creating a federal forum for the vindication of federal rights against state officials. Yet despite that predominant focus by Congress, this Court has concluded that Section 1983 claims are subject to concurrent, not exclusive jurisdiction. Turning to the disabling incompatibility test, here we have no inconsistency, much less in any incompatibility, between RICO's purposes and the state court adjudication of civil damage claims. The overriding purpose of RICO's civil damage provisions was to provide a remedy for innocent parties who are victimized by organized crime. Congress expressly admonished the courts to construe RICO liberally to effectuate those remedial purposes. This Court has consistently found that permitting the state courts to entertain federal causes of action facilitates the enforcement of federal rights. Here, recognizing state court jurisdiction over RICO claims will allow persons victimized by organized crime to pursue their claims in the first instance in forms which they may find more convenient or less expensive. Certainly, there is nothing inconsistent with RICO's remedial aims in providing plaintiffs this choice. Indeed, it is the closing, not the opening, of the state courts that would undermine RICO's purposes. Let me address briefly the three policy considerations on which petitioners rest their incompatibility argument. None, we submit, comes close to showing any disabling incompatibility. As I understand the argument today, they essentially collapsed two of those considerations into one. That is, the concern with uniformity of interpretation and what they have deemed the inappropriateness of state court interpretation of a statute that relies on federal criminal laws, in part. With respect to the uniformity argument, this identical argument was advanced and rejected by the Court in Dowd-Box. Just as in Dowd, there is simply no evidence here that Congress believed uniform interpretation to be any more important with respect to RICO than with respect to the myriad of other federal statutes that the state courts apply every day of the week. With respect to the inappropriateness of that petitioners allege of the state courts interpreting federal criminal laws, the concern, as I understand it today, is that somehow the state courts may create bad precedent by misinterpreting the federal criminal laws. In the first instance, as has been pointed out, the state courts are obliged to follow the precedents of this court in interpreting the federal criminal laws. There is nothing, moreover, in our constitutional scheme that prohibits the state courts from adjudicating federal criminal cases. Indeed, as the Court recognized in Testa v. Catt, there have been times in the history of our republic where Congress has delegated to the federal courts the enforcement of federal criminal laws. There's also nothing unique about recognizing concurrent jurisdiction of the state courts to hear civil cases where there is a criminal analog. That is exactly the situation in Section 1983. That statute, of course, has a criminal analog in 18 U.S.C. Section 242. Finally, the same incompatibility argument in different guise was made to the court in McMahon, and this court rejected it. The court said the argument was made that private arbitral panels were an inappropriate forum for there to be interpretation of straight federal criminal laws. The court rejected that. Certainly state courts have more experience in interpreting the criminal laws than private arbitral panels. Finally, there's been petitioners have made some argument concerning the fact that there are certain procedural advantages to proceeding in federal court, and that Congress's inclusion of those procedural advantages, expanded service of process, and broad venue, in some way evidences an intent by Congress to relegate all civil RICO claims to the federal courts. Those procedural benefits are just that, procedural. They are not substantive. They are not an integral part of RICO. And it is wholly consistent with RICO's remedial purposes to allow plaintiffs in the first instance to choose whether they want to avail themselves of those benefits of the federal courts or whether to pursue their claims in the state courts. Let me close by saying that this court has consistently and emphatically held that the state courts are competent and have inherent power to adjudicate both federal statutory and constitutional claims. Here, the exercise of concurrent state court jurisdiction will further not frustrate the remedial purposes of the statute. In view of the conceded absence of a statutory directive to the contrary and Congress's failure even to consider the issue during its legislative deliberations, it is clear that RICO does not fall within that limited class of cases in which the presumed jurisdiction of the state courts has been rebutted. We therefore urge the court to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Mr. Goldberger, you have 15 minutes remaining.
Just briefly. First, respondents place reliance on the Section 1983 cases which hold that jurisdiction is concurrent under that act and on the Dowd-Box decision. Both of those cases are distinguishable. In this case of Section 1983, this court in Patsy versus Board of Regents and Felder versus Casey engaged in an extensive analysis which demonstrated that Congress, in enacting Section 1983, in fact had an affirmative intent to retain concurrent jurisdiction over Section 1983 claims. The same is true with respect to the Dowd-Box decision. The court there engaged in analysis of Section 301 and determined that Congress, in enacting that section, intended to expand, not to contract, the four that were available for Section 301 actions. In addition, the respondents indicate that there is congressional history which shows that Congress did not intend to adapt all of the baggage of the Clayton Act to Section 1964C actions. There is some legislative history that supports that. But as Justice Marshall pointed out in his dissent in the Sedema case, and as other courts have pointed out as well, there is a limitation in that legislative history, which indicates that what Congress was concerned about was importing into Section 1964C concepts of antitrust standing and antitrust injury. There's no indication that Congress was concerned in any way of limiting this court's holding in Freeman and General Investment.
For exclusivity, is that the best you've got?
Your Honor, in terms of this case, I think that's the best we've got because Congress deliberately did model Section 1964.
Well, I know, but in holding that the Clayton Act enforcement is exclusively in the federal courts, are those two cases the best you've got?
Yes, Your Honor. Oh, no, there is another decision. In the Moraes decision, this court reaffirmed that holding and
Have you cited that? Did you cite that?
Yes, Your Honor. It appears at Moraes is – sorry, Your Honor.
Well, you didn't cite it along when you cited these other two.
No, Your Honor, we did not. Moraes appears at I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is it in your brief, in your index?
Thank you.
What's the name of the case?
It's Moraes versus American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, Your Honor.
Oh, yeah.
It's 470 U.S. 373.
And where is it cited?
It appears in the respondent's
brief,
Your Honor, at page 25.
Good show. Good show.
You also say you rely on a case called Continental something for the proposition that antitrust actions cannot be brought in state court. Am I misquoting?
I think so, Your Honor. I think it's General Investment.
General Investment.
General Investment and Freeman versus B Machine.
I don't find General Investment in your brief. Did you have a citation? I mean, I don't have to find it in your index. Did you have a citation?
There it is. That's the other side. Yeah.
Do you have an old?
It's 260,
261. 260 U.S. 261. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Going back to Maurice for a second, isn't that the case in which Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit, after the remand, suggested that maybe the old rule wasn't so...
Yes, Your Honor. The Seventh Circuit has in two opinions suggested that perhaps the Clayton Act decisions were not the best decided decisions. But I think the point here to reiterate is not whether the Clayton Act decisions were the best decided decisions, but rather that Congress, in enacting Section 1964C, was aware of those decisions and made no change in applicable language when it enacted Section 1964C. Finally, I'd just like to address the contention that RICO actions, there's nothing anomalous about state court judges interpreting federal law since federal court judges will be interpreting state law under RICO actions, which is, I understand, the argument the respondents to have made. Congress made a choice when it enacted RICO. It made a choice to, in fact, federalize some state criminal laws. It anticipated, therefore, that federal court judges would, in fact, be interpreting state criminal laws. It did not anticipate that federal laws would be interpreted in the state, federal criminal laws would be interpreted in the state courts, and that somehow Section 3231 would be changed by the enactment of Section 1964C. For all the reasons I've just stated and the reasons I stated in my opening remarks, we would urge the Court to reverse the judgment below.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberger. The case...
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.